From the small towns
to the big cities,
we bring you the stories that matter.
This is
the Our American Stories podcast.
This is Lee Habib, the host of the Our American Stories podcast. We can't wait to bring you these fantastic stories from our team. They work hard day in and day out to bring you stories from everyday Americans. We tell the stories about this great country that may not be perfect, but it sure is beautiful. If you'd like to support us and all that we do here, visit OurAmericanStories.com and go to the Giving tab. Join our team in all the work we do and become a part of all that's going on here. We're a nonprofit, and we appreciate both one-time gifts and monthly donations. It's for you and through you that we tell these stories. And now, we have the story of Emma McCormick, who took advantage of the ability to work remotely, bought a sailboat, and went to Florida. And also the story of Archbishop John Hughes, who fought to defend Catholics at a time when they were a persecuted religious group in this country. But first, the story of a man who paid his own child support after his father left him at the age of 6. Here's Jason Wolfe's story of becoming the father he never had himself.
You know, I think my very first memories were when I was living in Virginia. My dad worked in the CIA, so we lived in a place called Reston, Virginia, which was like a new suburb of Washington, D.C. back then. I could remember having a bike and learning how to ride a bike with my dad, and I must have been maybe 3 or 4. And I remember going down this little hill that he was pushing me down and, you know, basically being scared and then being happy that I learned how to ride a bike. So. Yeah, it was my earliest memory. Something that happened in my life that I remember that was like a pivotal thing, probably when my mom and dad got separated. By then, it was 1975, so I was 6 or so. And I could remember my dad driving, he had a Volkswagen, sort of like a station wagon Volkswagen. Loaded all of us up into this Volkswagen, drove up to Connecticut. And all of us, meaning my brother and sister and I, drove us up to Connecticut and dropped us off with my grandparents, with my mom. My mom was acting strange. I didn't know what was going on. And then he left, and that was the beginning of their divorce. And shortly after that, my mom, turned out later I found out, my mom had mental illness, and so she was put into a sort of a mental institution for a couple years. So for a couple years after my dad dropped us off, my mom was, you know, going through trying to get herself back together. And yeah, that's probably the next milestone in my life. I could remember when my mother was, they were trying to get her to take her into this mental institution, whatever, she was put away for a couple years. And they somehow couldn't get her. She was elusive. And I could remember my sister and I going to this hospital. And they were getting her there under some other guise, some other trick to get her to show up. And so she shows up, and my sister and I are sitting out there. By now, I'm probably a little older, 6 or 7. And I remember they had my sister and I playing sort of games out inside this room. And I remember hearing some screaming. And I look over, and here's my mother running towards me with a straitjacket on, because they were trying to put her into a straitjacket. And that was like hugely pivotal and kind of crazy at that time. And from then, over the next course of a couple years, I mean, we lived with grandparents. I lived with an aunt for a little bit, and then eventually moved in with an uncle. And my mom came out of the institution, tried to take us back, get back on her feet. Living in sort of, you know, welfare life, not a lot of money, poor, I can remember a Christmas vividly when I was around 9 at this point, and just laying under a blanket with no heat in the house and getting a knock at the door. And at the door was, looked out the door, was a box with frozen turkey and some games for us. And, you know, we couldn't cook the turkey. We had no gas. So we had no gas to light the stove. We were the poor people. We were the, what I called the raggies. You know, the raggies of town, the people that were real raggy and poor and stuff, that was us. And so, yeah, I remember that. And then living with an uncle and then having to make a decision when I was about 10, whether I wanted to go to this new school that they discovered, that this nun that we were going to a church told my grandmother about down in Hershey, Pennsylvania. It was a school for, at the time, it was boy school. And they were just converting over to add girls. And it was in the late 70s, 79 or so. And we went down, took the test, came back, and my brother didn't pass the test, I did. And they asked me, I can remember standing at my uncle's house on the second floor, and they were asking me, do you want to go to the school or do you want to go with your uncle, aunt and uncle to go to California, because they were moving to California. And I decided to go to Milton Hershey School alone by myself, which was hugely, you know, that was a God moment. There was no real reason for me to choose to not go with my family, but I chose to not go with my family, to go down to Milton Hershey School. And so on September 20th, 1980, it was a fall day, crisp out, football season, sunny. I'll remember it just like yesterday, and I could feel the air, even right now, and being dropped off at Milton Hershey School. And my mother and my grandparents were there, and inside this place called the Rotunda, which is a huge building at Milton Hershey School. And I can remember Mr. Long standing there with me. He was the person that had the intake of children coming into Milton Hershey School. And I can remember standing with Mr. Long and looking at my parents and missing my mother. By now, I thought my dad was dead because my mom told us he was not alive, so he never paid child support, and we really thought he was dead. So seeing my mother cry, my grandparents standing there, and then they walk away, and I'm alone now. I didn't realize, but that I'd be on my own for a long time thereafter. And growing up in that school, I can remember not even a few months into it, maybe crying every night, trying to put myself to sleep, and starting to try to get used to the school. At the time was a, you know, corporal punishment was not, it was something that happened. It just happened, right? It was part of discipline. And I can remember running away, and I remember getting paddled. I remember these things that I wasn't used to, and it was scary, and I cried, and I didn't want to be there. But I learned to adapt and to change, to figure things out. Eventually I did. And eventually I excelled. I played three sports, football, baseball, and wrestling. Some of them I was a captain on, some of the teams I excelled in. My grades were always good. I was in the top group of our class, probably in the top, you know, handful of kids. And then, you know, went on to college. But before going on to college, I remember sitting at graduation day. Next pivotal moment was just sitting there and, you know, with a suitcase of clothes and $100, because they gave you a check at the time of $100. I think mine was less than $100 because I owed the school something for something that I did. I don't even know. And I couldn't cash the check because I didn't have a bank account. And I had a suitcase with the brand new clothes, you know, three pairs of socks, 10 pair of underwear, something like that, a bunch of pants, you know. And I'm sitting there with this big suitcase of clothes, this check I can't cash. And my grandfather had a stroke, so he was on the last months of his life. My mother was always, you know, dysfunctional. And I wasn't really sure what I was going to do, you know. So I went up to Connecticut, and I stayed with my grandmother to help her to take care of my grandfather until he died. And he passed away within a couple months. And I didn't go to college. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And so I got involved in like a lot of things that somebody who has no family, who has no direction, no male mentorship, Christ not in my life to any large measure. And so I got involved in things that were illegal. And I didn't do, you know, I'm not proud about it, but there was a stretch of my life right there that I was kind of going down the wrong roads. And, yeah.
Thankfully, Jason, after a number of setbacks, had a moment of clarity. And after years of hard work, he created the first coupon website ever, and then the first real software to use cookies to track web browsing, which he sold for roughly $22 million.
So that was 2006, and by then I was married. I was only married for a couple years, and I had a son, Morris, and I ended up going through divorce. I get the old, you know, you're locked out of your home type of deal. I go into my house and all the locks are changed. I was only married for 2 years. I didn't know the person I was getting married to. I only knew her for 4 months before I got married. And I married her because she was pregnant. So during that divorce and after that divorce, it was a time for me, I think, to when God started knocking on my door and saying, hey, all this stuff you've got to do, you've got to be starting to change the way you live and put God first. Even though going through divorce wasn't fun, it was, you know, financially it was a mess. It was because I sold a company during the time that I was married, it became a marital asset, and that was a big problem. But I started to go to church more. I was invited into a men's group, and I started the journey to change my life, to bring me as a man more towards Christ in a real way, as opposed to just saying that I'm a Christian. When I got divorced, it was easy for, you know, the lawyers to say, hey, you know, let's just kind of settle this disagreement. And I'm signing papers, honestly. I didn't realize this, Robbie, that is saying that I didn't know what the lingo meant at the time. I didn't know what primary custody meant compared to just custody. I didn't know what legal custody meant. All I just knew was, like, you have the kid or you don't. I quickly figured it out because I didn't have equal physical and legal custody. I had sort of visitation rights. I think that's terrible for dads at the time, and that's how it was for me. And I had to then try to argue with the court that I could be an equal father and I wanted to be equally in Morris's life. And his mom tried to stop that. And so for years, from 2006 all the way up to 2011, we fought for equal custody. And eventually in 2000, I think it was 11 or 10, the governor at the time, Rendell, Pennsylvania, was leaving office, and he put a change to the law or the thing about parental equal custody. At the time, I had to prove that I was an equal father. Like, I was proved that I was, instead of just automatically giving equal custody to both parents and then disproving that the other person couldn't be a parent. And so when he did that, it allowed me to have 50-50 custody. It was a wonderful thing. And I think that's how it always should have been, but it wasn't at the time. So yeah, it took years for me to fight for him to just be in his life. And he was a big part of my life. We spent, I didn't get remarried until 2017. So for 10 years, it was just Morris and I and my dog, Toby, our dog, Toby. And, you know, I spent a lot of time with him. I focused on Morris. I did his homework with him. I was involved in the school. I was involved with his doctors. I was an equally involved father, as it should be. And I loved it. I loved to be involved in his life. He's older now, 15, 16. Kids change. He's doesn't want to listen to me as much as he did before, but that's okay. Since then, I did get remarried, and we have fostered and we have adopted. So we have two girls now that we've adopted. Danielle, who's 5, and Marigold, who is 8. We got them when they were 3 and 6. So we love them. We have two new girls, and we have a boy right now too. We foster. His name is Jeremiah. And Jeremiah, we hope, eventually will be our son. And so our family went from just Morris and I and our dog to Susan, my wonderful wife, Danielle, Marigold, Morris, Jeremiah, the dogs, and my wife loves animals. We have a donkey and a goat, 2 goats, and a pony. So yeah, things have expanded. That's good. All these struggles, all these challenges that I had, I learned later in life that, you know, it was God banging on my heart My heart was getting broken over and over and over. And it was because God wanted to get into my heart. My heart was hard. And so I think these struggles have made my heart softer.
And a softer, gentler heart was needed when Jason had to face the man he'd grown up thinking was dead. The man who left his family when he was six. His own father.
And so I found out my dad was alive in 1992. I was 21 years old. I was in college and found out he was alive. We sent letters to my grandmother who wouldn't tell us where he was. And then she would send the letters to my father. And he, lo and behold, wasn't dead. and found out he lived in New Zealand. He had a whole different life. And I ended up going down and meeting him probably when I was 23. I spent about a month with him, got to know him a little bit, and over the course of a couple years, knew him a little bit more, but I wasn't with Christ yet. And so what I decided to do was to say to my dad, listen, I don't forgive you unless you apologize. You need to apologize to my mom, you need to apologize to my grandmother, because I am the judge. I didn't leave it up to God, I left it up to myself. I'm gonna dictate this situation. So he did. He sent a letter to my mom and my grandmother. And now my grandmother and my mother knows where he lives, right? And so now all of a sudden it's a lawsuit. It's my mom suing my dad because he never paid child support. Now my dad's wanted and in the United States couldn't come back here. And if he did, he'd go to jail. And he had a judgment against him of $418,000 in back child support and interest and everything else, penalties, whatever. So he couldn't come back. And it was because of me that happened. And because of my thought that I needed to tell somebody what to do, or I needed to be the judge of somebody else, that caused him that pain. So I felt bad about that. And so when I sold the last company in 2016, I hired a lawyer and I found the documents down in Virginia, the divorce documents between my mom and my dad, found the settlement amount or the amount that they had leaned against my dad. And I went up to Connecticut and met with my mom and convinced her to allow me to pay her on behalf of my father. So I would pay her. I'd buy her house at the time. The house was probably worth $100,000. I gave her $200,000. I gave her a commitment of $2,000 a month over the rest of her life and gave her some other stuff in exchange for her releasing my father of the debt that he owed her. And she did. And so it was a proud moment for me to be able to tell my dad, hey, listen, I settled your debt to my mom. And I was able to live that out because of my faith. Now, my father, all his years, was not very close to the Lord. I think he was probably an atheist or agnostic at best. And in the last several years, he married somebody, Rebecca, who was a Christian. And now my dad, at like the 75 years old, is going to church. And he's in a small group at church. you can't make this stuff up, I'm telling you. And so it's been a really great journey for me with my dad. And, you know, I forgave him. I forgave him in the right way. I didn't forgive him because of me telling him what to do. I forgave him because Christ forgave me. And I think that's been special for me.
And what a remarkable piece of storytelling. Thanks to Robbie for producing the piece. As always, he does such great work. And a special thanks also to Jason Wolfe for sharing his story, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And boy, there was a lot of ugly and a lot of bad. But my goodness, what came from all those struggles? What came from all those knocks? That sort of rugged beauty that can come from a life that's lived on the edge and then shaped to beauty. And that seminal moment in his life is, as he put it, when God came knocking on my door, that it was time to put him first. He'd had a hard heart, and God softened his heart, he confessed. And by the way, he had every reason to have a hard heart. My goodness, being abandoned by his father, the mental illness of his mother, being alone all that time, then the divorce, then the fight to get equal custody of his son. And in the end, all those struggles and challenges, that was God banging on my heart. My heart was hard. And then he found his dad at the age of 22, tried to reconcile, forgave him incorrectly the first time and correctly the second, and it changed everything. And if you have a story to share, we want to hear it. Send them to OurAmericanStories.com. That's OurAmericanStories.com. And click on the Your Stories tab. We can't wait to hear from you. And up next, Emma McCormick, Hillsdale College graduate, who took advantage of the opportunity to work remotely by buying a sailboat and moving to Florida. Here's Monty with a story.
The allure of the sea. It's hard not to deny it when it comes beckoning. If you've ever so much as looked at a boat, it's hard not to imagine what it'd be like to own one. One person who decided to make those dreams into reality is Emma McCormick, who did it on a whim, of course.
Well, my name is Emma, and I'm a financial analyst at General Motors. Right now, I'm a sailor. I grew up in Idaho. I, like, never even noticed sailboats. Didn't know anything about it. And then after college, when I moved to Detroit, I was new to the city. I didn't know anybody. And I was out for a run one day, and I saw a poster that said, "Free, no experience necessary, learn to sail." So, like, that sounds perfect. It sounds like so much fun. And so I just showed up, and it was at a yacht club that had a race series. And they would take new people and just put you on a boat. I did some training and learning with them over the winter and then sailed with them in every regatta I could.
But in 2020, Emma was told she'd be working remotely and decided to make the most of it. If she could work remotely, she could live remotely too. But what to live in was the question she had to answer.
I thought about a sailboat for a fleeting second, but then I kind of doubted myself. I was like, I probably can't do that by myself. So then I thought about a van, and then I was talking to a sailing friend, and we were talking about the possibilities of doing that, but that was also pretty far-fetched. But then I was like, well, you know, I could probably just do this by myself. I don't know, it just seemed like more fun, and sailing is a lot more fun than driving, and it all came together. Really at the last minute, I canceled my lease before I had even officially bought a boat. The second hardest part about owning a boat is finding one to buy. Obviously, the first hardest part is maintaining the boat. All of them are going to have something wrong with them. I spent almost 2 full months searching, just looking into different types of boats. But I ended up finding this boat. I found it. It was listed on Craigslist, and the man who was selling it was 92. And he actually only bought the boat when he was 88.
And with the boat bought, she did what so many other people from the Midwest do when spring rolls around. She went to Florida. But what's her house like?
So it's 25 feet long. It's about 8.5 feet wide. The headroom is actually about 4 feet 9 inches, which means I can't stand up in my boat. Technically, 4 people could sleep on this boat. We've actually slept 5 for a few nights in a row. I had actually never slept on a boat until I bought this. I have a little galley or kitchen with a 2-burner alcohol stove. It's like your living room, your dining room, there's storage behind them. So yeah, I'm generally a pretty tidy person to begin with. I like things to be organized, which I think is good because living on a boat in such a small space where your living room, dining room, kitchen, bedroom, it's all the same. If you leave something sitting out, the whole place looks like a mess. So I think you just need to be prepared to put a lot of work into it. I mean, there's definitely people who live on boats here who put zero work into it and their boats reflect that. But if you want to live somewhere nice, like, you got to maintain it. I think just be prepared for work. Be prepared for things to take longer than you expect and cost more than you expect. But to move down here definitely simplified things a lot, down to like 1 pot and 1 pan and a handful of shirts.
So what's living in a marina like, and who are the kinds of people who spend time there? Unsurprisingly, they're a very eclectic group of people who certainly like to talk to Emma.
The sailing community, the boating community, everyone is so kind and so excited, and they especially if you're younger. Being around the marina, like, I can hardly go to the bathroom because there's bathrooms and showers and laundry and everything in the entrance lounge area to the marina. So I can hardly walk there without talking to somebody because there's always people out and about and there's always interesting people. And it probably depends on where you are. Like, I'm in the marina here, so maybe a little bit different clientele than people who just anchor in some random bayou. But I do love hearing people's stories and what brings them here. Like, one of my friends, like, broke up with his girlfriend, and so he just, like, wanted to move to a new state, do something different. And it's a fun life. There's several families with young kids, and they have day jobs. Like, I think one family I'm thinking of, the wife's a doctor, the husband runs a sail rigging company, and they've got their whole family lives on their catamaran.
But have any of her friends from up north come to visit? Of course they have.
Yeah, it's funny. I told all my friends, hey, I'm in Florida, I have a boat, it's warm and sunny, come visit. And I wasn't sure how many people would actually jump on that and buy a plane ticket and come down, but everyone I've told about it has. Like, I have guests basically every weekend, which is a ton of fun. Most of them have never been on sailboats, and so they love my boat until I show them a friend's boat that's bigger. But they're impressed.
And just a delightful piece, and a special thanks to Monty Montgomery for snagging it, and a special thanks to Emma McCormick for telling her story. She had some time to do remote work, and she did what so many Americans do. She pursued her own version of the American dream and decided to live on a sailboat in a beautiful marina in a beautiful part of the country where it was nice and warm. We're so glad you found the Our American Stories podcast. Help others discover us by giving us a 5-star rating. It really helps us out on Apple Podcasts and Spotify or whatever platform you listen to us on. Help others find us so they can hear these amazing stories from this good and great country. And finally, the story of Archbishop John Hughes. From the 17th to the 19th centuries, Catholics faced routine discrimination and persecution for simply being, well, Catholic. Following the arrival of the Irish after the potato famine, stood one man who would go toe-to-toe with hostile Protestants. Here's Joey with the story.
Richard McCann is the author of the book, John Hughes, Lion of American Catholicism.
Imagine a young man arriving from a foreign country to the United States in the year of 1819. It's November. It's the beginning of wintertime. It's cold. He's just come from his native county, Tyrone, in Ireland, a young man in a new country, a strange country, but in his heart and in his soul with a burning desire to find a life for himself in a place that obviously he wasn't able to find in his own country.
Because he was born a Catholic in Protestant English-controlled Ireland, John Hughes famously noted that for the first 5 days of his life, he enjoyed social and civil equality with the most favored subjects in the British Empire. But that ended on the day of his baptism. Here's Bill Duggan on the backstory of Catholic persecution in Ireland.
Most of England, Ireland, and Scotland was Catholic. And when Henry VIII wanted to divorce his wife and marry Anne Boleyn, he did not get a dispensation from Rome. And thereby he founded the Church of England. And so from then on, the Catholic religion itself was persecuted, and then it was heavily persecuted. Most of Scotland converted to the Protestant religion, the Church of England. Of course, the English England converted to the Church of England, but the Irish people wouldn't in general. And this created such a hatred against the Irish, a Catholic at the time. So when you look at all of this, the discrimination, the hatred of the English over the Irish, one can only say, you know, that it was an extremely difficult place to live.
At the time that John Hughes was growing up in County Tyrone, it was still an age that was fraught with a lot of religious dissension and religious animosity between Catholics and Protestants. The Hughes family was a Catholic family. They lived in a largely Protestant area in County Tyrone in a place called Analogan. And there were a number of Protestant families around the Hughes family. And there were various groups and various factions that were constantly warring with each other on a sectarian basis. Now, John Hughes's father was a man of tremendous integrity, a man who was upright and respected in the communities of both the Catholic as well as Protestant peoples. And in one instance, John was coming back from school one day, and he was stopped on the road by a group of men who were armed with muskets and bayonets. And what they were going to do to the youngster, one can only speculate. But one of the men in the party, this was a Protestant group, they recognized him as being the son of John Hughes Sr. And as a result, they let him go because they all agreed that the father was an upright man and not a man that was, you know, the focus of any animosity on their part. And as a result, he was spared and he was allowed to continue on his way. In another instance in his youth, one that really colored his perceptions of the world he was leaving, occurred when his younger sister died and was being buried, and the Catholic priest was not allowed to enter into the cemetery area because of the prohibitions in place because of the penal laws that still existed. Some dirt was scooped up, and it was given to a person who scattered it over the corpse, or over the coffin, rather, before it was lowered into the ground. And this left a terrible, burning resentment in the heart of John Hughes about the fact that his people were second-class citizens in Ireland and that his own sister couldn't be buried by a priest of their own faith in the proper fashion.
And so John and his family moved to America to seek a better life. But little did they know, America had been wrought with nativist anti-Catholic bigotry for some time.
Roman Catholicism was a religion that was virtually under prohibition in every colony of the old 13 colonies. The oldest prohibitions were in Virginia, where as early as 1642, there were laws passed saying that anybody ordained by the Pope of Rome or any deacon or any person associated with that religious sect would be subject to persecution. And I mean persecution in the sense that they would be hung or they would be in some way put to death. Massachusetts was not very far off from that. The Puritans of Massachusetts had a particular disdain for Roman Catholicism. And even though there were no known Catholics in the colony of the Massachusetts Bay for some 20 years after its founding, it still did not prevent them from passing a series of laws directed against the practice of Roman Catholicism and prohibitions against its clergy. This was true throughout all of the colonies. And it was a very bad situation. So Catholics were a small minority, but they were a persecuted minority. As long as they basically remained out of sight, they would not foment the kind of turbulence around them that, you know, was associated with the kind of overt bigotry that we would see later on with church burnings and attacks against the clergy. And so John Hughes came into an environment in the United States where Roman Catholicism was sort of like, you know, America's best kept secret. It was there. It was quietly tolerated. But if it became too vocal or if it became too big and too present, it would sort of engender the most serious kind of reaction by Protestants against its existence.
The onset of the famine came while he was here in the U.S. Father Hughes started to receive in famine Irish in his ministry and started to understand just how much hatred was out there. So as we move forward, he was promoted Archbishop by Pope Gregory in 1837, which was pretty remarkable since he was ordained priest in 1826, becoming a bishop in 1837 at Old St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is where he had moved to from Philadelphia because of the emerging growth of the Irish Catholic that had been coming in on famine ships. They call them coffin ships. But, you know, the Irish were just getting off the land. And the reason they were getting off the land is the landowners were the English aristocracy. They were forcing them off. They were, you know, paying their passage just to get them out of Ireland. The food was not there and they were starving. So they put them on the cheapest passage they could find to get them out of the country. And they started to land in places like Newfoundland and Nova Scotia, all the way down the coast. And many of them even walked across borders from Canada into the U.S. because that was the cheapest passage. But then you had Boston and you had New York and Philadelphia and Baltimore and on down to Savannah as well. These Irish coffin ships would come in and just unload the cargo of people with nothing more than the rags on their back. A lot of them died on the voyage, the journey across. where I grew up, there's a cemetery from the Irish famine that housed 7,500 famine Irish that died on the coffin ships coming over on Staten Island. They buried them on a potter's field, which happens to now be a golf course called Silver Lake Golf Course, and they're buried on the 18th fairway. John Joseph Hughes, then Bishop Hughes, was made Archbishop, but he then had to find a solution to this crisis. So he started very strong to support the Irish Catholic emergence into New York. And at one time, the Irish made up more than half of the city of New York in population. That's how many tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands eventually had been deported into New York. And New York became just a robust area of Irish Catholics coming in, just destitute and starving. And Hughes had an enormous challenge to try and help the people find a way and be somewhat housed and fed and all that. And of course, being so devoutly Catholic, the Irish are at the time and still are, they always turn to the church. So it came onto Hughes's shoulders to try and help and find ways to support them.
Most Catholic children, if they were in school at all, were forced to go to the Protestant-dominated public schools at that time, which were overseen by the Protestant School Society. And in those schools, they had to be subjected daily to revilement against their priests, the Pope, against their prayers, against their religious life. So the alternative was they didn't go to school at all because, of course, there was no parochial school system at that time.
In the public school system, they were teaching religion, but they were teaching the Protestant religion through the King James Bible. And he stood up against that and, you know, said that religion should be free and people should be able to practice their own religion and not be forced into this. So that led to a huge movement that he took on, and eventually he founded the Catholic school system.
In New York, as bishop, he fought nativism and bigotry literally toe-to-toe and nail-to-nail with some of the greatest bigots of the time.
So Hughes is an enormous presence in New York at the time. He was fiery, he was tough. Some called him an Irish chieftain at the time, but he had to be. He had to stand up to so many things.
He engaged in a series of debates with the Reverend John Breckinridge, who was a noted Presbyterian minister. John Breckinridge had graduated from Yale. His father had been Attorney General of the United States under Thomas Jefferson. He was a noted Presbyterian theologian, and he was sort of watching this emerging Catholic priest, this young John Hughes, and he wanted to have a shot at him in terms of debating the various points of Catholicism and Protestantism. And so in a series of debates that lasted from 1833 until 1836, both in written as well as oral form, Hughes and Breckinridge argued a number of points about the differences of the two religious beliefs. The first set of debates, which took place starting in 1833, was over the rule of faith, a debate about the rule of faith, which rule of faith was more valid, that of the Catholic Church or that of Protestantism. And from 1835 until 1836, a number of oral debates they conducted was on the issue as to whether or not the Catholic Church in any of its principles was inimical to civil or religious liberty. It was those debates that made John Hughes sort of a national figure in the Catholic Church in the United States. Never before had debates of this type taken place. Never before had a Catholic cleric stood toe-to-toe with a member of the Protestant clergy, and in this case, a member of the clergy as prominent as Breckinridge was. John Hughes was trying to, in the process of the debate, show that the entire Protestant movement was invalid because the rule of faith, according to Hughes, was something that had come into creation after the Reformation started. Christ had established his church. Christ never told any of the apostles to write the scriptures. The scriptures were written, the canonical books were set back in the first century of the Christian era. And that was, you know, in addition to what the sayings of councils were and papal decrees and so forth, that formed the basis for the rule of faith, which was followed pretty much by the Catholic Church, by the Universal Church, until the time of the Reformation. Once the Reformation began, there was a new rule of faith that broke completely from that past. And so John Hughes maintained that the Protestant rule of faith could not have existed from the beginning of Christ or the Christian Church, because it had only come into existence since the beginning of the Reformation. So there was a period that was a complete break from what the traditions of the past had been. From the standpoint of Breckinridge, Breckinridge attacked the Catholic Church from the position of its idolatry, its worship of the Pope, kind of viewing the Pope as a dictator, the Pope not being in any way the creature of Scripture or the product of Scripture or the product of anything about the Church itself. From the standpoint of Protestants, the Bible, the Word, is the very essence of Protestant belief. Catholics, on the other hand, the fonts of revelation for Catholics derive from Scripture, but they also derive from tradition. And tradition being councils, decrees, various pronunciations of popes regarding articles of faith and so forth. So for Protestants, if it's not a part of the Word, if it's not a part of Scripture, a part of the Bible itself, it doesn't exist. It's not valid. His response was that the whole idea of Scripture evolved over a period of time. All of the books of the Bible, the accepted books of the Bible, the New Testament, the canon of the New Testament was something which didn't just happen overnight. It happened over a period of many, many, many years. Christ himself didn't make that determination. Those works were inspired. They were written by the gospel writers and so forth. And so according to Hughes, the Protestant view of the Word only, the Bible only, was not a valid point because the Bible, as they accepted it, as they regarded it from the standpoint of it being the firm basis of their beliefs, didn't exist at that particular time. It took a number of years before all of those books came together and were accepted as the basis for faith. And that's what Hughes was attacking. Breckinridge's only compelling response was to resort to a lot of the age-old tactics of being critical of... I'll give an example of one of the line of attacks that Breckinridge used. He criticized the Pope for setting aside a day for blessing all of the animals in the Vatican, all the donkeys and all of the animals, and yet at the same time he was condemning Bible societies as being, you know, the spreaders of heresy. And Breckinridge condemned the Pope for establishing a sort of a precedence of beasts of burden over what the Word of God was. But those were typical types of tactics that were used to attack Catholicism at that particular time. A number of conversions took place during the period of the debates in question. Catholics and Protestants were very interested in these debates. And the reason they were interested was because nothing of the type had ever taken place in the past. And so a number of Protestants, one, the Reverend McCalla, who was a noted Presbyterian minister, he approached Bishop Hughes, he approached Father Hughes at that time. He wasn't yet a bishop. He was still a priest. He approached Father Hughes with the idea of trying to obtain from Hughes a book or a source of books where he could read and study the things in support of the arguments that Hughes was making to show where McCalla was wrong in his thinking and where he might be enlightened. And there were a number of people who approached Hughes as a result of that. In the wake of the debates and in the wake of the exchanges between Breckinridge and Hughes, the Catholic Church and Hughes, Hughes acquitted the Catholic Church and himself very well in the face of Breckinridge. So much so that there was grumbling among a number of Protestants, mostly Presbyterian leaders, that Breckinridge was not the person who should have been the one representing the Protestant point of view. So actually, Breckinridge came down somewhat in the estimate of some of his own people because he was not forceful enough in showing up the Catholic Church as some kind of a charlatan religious experience and making more of the fact that it was a religion based on superstition and idolatry. Hughes kind of destroyed that entire concept. And as a result, Breckinridge sort of suffered from the standpoint of reduced esteem in the eyes of his own people. And what those debates achieved was it did a few things. First of all, Roman Catholicism, which up until that time was still largely a persecuted and minority religious faith in the United States, suddenly emerged from the shadows. It suddenly acquired recognition as a legitimate faith. Its clergy were now looked upon not as, you know, the superstitious minions of a pope in Rome, but rather an educated, intelligent clergy, because Hughes defended himself and acquitted himself quite admirably against, frankly, the better speaker, who was Breckinridge, the better educated, who was Breckinridge. But Hughes acquitted himself in a marvelously wonderful way in a way that gave new legitimacy to Catholicism and in a way that made Roman Catholics feel as if they had a solid leader to express their particular point of view. You see, up until that time, there was a great reluctance for Catholics to become involved in any controversies with Protestants. Even the Catholic clergy advised their people to be passive in the face of attacks by Protestants, so as to not rock the boat, not to stir the pot. And Hughes changed all that because, first of all, his personality was such that he was always game for a fight, and secondly, because he felt that it was his obligation to defend and to protect his faith against the onslaught of the kinds of bigotry that was so prevalent at that time against Catholicism in the United States. John Hughes was faced with a massive problem on his hands with the Irish immigrants. You have to realize that the Irish had been separated from their church for almost 150 years prior to the famine. It was only in the late 1700s that the full effects of the penal laws were starting to be diminished. And Catholic emancipation didn't come to Ireland until 1829. And so the institutional Catholic Church had been in effect dormant and had almost been disemboweled for that entire period of time. There was no real institutional church to speak of. Priests were considered felons. They were on the run. They said mass in hedges. They said them in forlorn places in mountain areas. They were subject to persecution and death if they were caught. Any concept of doctrine and so forth, or dogma, or catechism was almost non-existent. As a matter of fact, for a lot of country people in Ireland, many of whom made their way to the United States on the coffin ships, their religious experience was a combination of Catholicism and paganism. So Hughes not only had to re-church his people, making them solid Catholics again, he was also faced with a tremendous humanitarian crisis from the standpoint of, how am I going to feed these people? How am I going to house them? How am I going to do things to get them involved in employment? And so for John Hughes, the answer was that he had to create a system, a social system that encompassed virtually all the building blocks of life. Now, he did that in a number of different ways. He did that, first of all, by launching an extensive parish building program. When Hughes became Bishop of New York in 1842, there were only a dozen parishes in the entire portion of the New York diocese, and that was mostly in Manhattan, because the New York diocese at one time encompassed about half the state of New Jersey as well. So it was a huge, huge area, geographically, of which there were about 2.6 million residents at the time, and they were serviced by fewer than 40 priests. Most of the churches that existed at that time were in debt, badly in debt. So Hughes had to now deal with the fact that we have a people who are coming who are in need of rechurching, of social support, of employment support. So he directed the full effects of his religious institution, of the Catholic Church, to serving the needs of the immigrant community, from aid societies to parish expansion to building of churches, where the church became the central building of the Irish neighborhood, a place where people could meet, a place where they could worship, a place where they could exchange news, a place where they could meet their neighbors, to employment prospects, to helping people provide food for their families, to even establishing of banks, the Immigrant Savings Bank, which opened in 1852 to promote thrift and savings amongst the Irish. And the greatest example being that Hughes and his priests were also involved in being a part of the bank. They made their deposits there. The parishes made the Immigrant Bank its depository for parish funds. And it was by that example that Hughes was able to direct the massive efforts of the Catholic Church into rebuilding a people who had been destroyed by famine and who had been destroyed by persecution in their own native country.
Leading to a revival of Irish Catholics, which did not sit well with the American nativists.
In 1844, there was a group of nativists who had been invited to New York to parade in the wake of the burning of St. Augustine's in Philadelphia. St. Augustine's was a Roman Catholic church, which was burnt to the ground by nativists. And the nativists who had participated in that church burning had been invited by a fellow nativist group in New York to come to New York and to parade in New York and to, of course, celebrate the triumph of nativism and to show solidarity with their Philadelphia nativist brothers. Now, John Hughes was aware of what was happening, and he told his people, his Catholics, that they were not to go near this parade, that they were not to in any way involve themselves, because he believed that the nativist mob would make any excuse whatsoever to turn the situation into a situation where it would seem as if the Catholics had provoked a riot and they had attacked the Protestant nativist mob.
Archbishop Hughes went to the mayor of New York and said to him that if one church in New York is burned, this place will look like a second Moscow. Now, what he meant was that during that time, early years in the early 1800s, Moscow was burned to the ground by protest and revolutionaries.
I could read you the actual transcript of their conversation. I can tell you exactly word for word what they said to each other. "Are you afraid," asked the mayor, this is Mayor Robert Hunter Morris, "that some of your churches will be burned?" "No," replied Hughes, "but I am afraid that some of yours will be burned. We can protect our own. I came to warn you for your own good." So Hughes was in effect telling the mayor of New York, "Listen, if one of our churches is touched, there's no guarantee that your churches aren't going to be attacked, and I'm letting you know that you better be prepared to protect your own." And then at that point, Robert Hunter Morris said to Hughes, "Do you think, Bishop, that your people would attack the procession?" In which Hughes responded, "I do not. But the Native Americans want to provoke a Catholic riot, and if they can do it in no other way, I believe they would not scruple to attack the procession themselves for the sake of making it appear that the Catholics had assailed them." Then Robert Hunter Morris said to Hughes, "What then would you have me do?" As if it wasn't obvious what he should do. To which Hughes replied, "I did not come here to tell you what to do. I am a churchman, not the mayor of New York. But if I were the mayor, I would examine the laws of the state and see if they were not attached to the police force, a battery of artillery, a company of infantry, and a squadron of horses. And if you do find out, they should be called out. Moreover, I should send word to Mayor Harper, the mayor-elect, who has been chosen by the votes of this party," meaning the nativists, "and they should warn him not to carry out their design, otherwise there will be a riot. I urge him to use his influence in preventing his public reception of the delegates," the delegates being, of course, the mob that was coming from Philadelphia. Now, here was an example of how John Hughes, a Roman Catholic churchman, faced off against the mayor of the city of New York, who also was sort of an anti-Catholic himself, and he told him in no uncertain terms, "If you attack our people, if you attack our churches, there are going to be repercussions, and those repercussions aren't going to be nice. It was not what you call turn-your-cheek Christianity. It was what you call an affirmative response to the threat of violence." Now, in preparation for any situation, Old St. Patrick's Cathedral, located down on Mott and Mulberry Street, between Prince on Mott and Mulberry Street, which was the original St. Patrick's Cathedral of New York City, the sidewalks in those days were made of wooden planks, and so the planks were torn up. They were brought inside the walls of the cathedral because there was a cemetery there and there was a wall that surrounded it. And members of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, a Catholic organization that had been organized in Ireland in the 1500s to protect the mass, the priest, and the church, assumed defense of the St. Patrick's campus. They bored holes through the walls of the cemetery, which to this day can still be seen if they haven't been filled in. And they were prepared to be holes for musket fire. Muskets could be stuck through the holes. And they were surrounding or preparing the perimeter of the campus for an attack by nativists. And Hughes made it very clear, if that happened, there was going to be retaliation. To make a long story short, the nativists did not riot. There were no attacks against Catholic churches. There were no attacks against Catholics. John Hughes had prevailed, and he made it quite clear that as a Catholic bishop, he was going to defend his people. This was quite in contrast to what happened in Philadelphia and places like St. Louis, where Catholic churches had been attacked, and in Boston, Massachusetts as well. Catholic churches had been attacked. They had been burned to the ground. But this did not happen in New York because John Hughes made it very, very clear that if anything of the sort happened, there would be definite retaliation. So he was a very courageous and a very steadfast bishop in that respect.
They called him Dagger Hughes, John Dagger Hughes, and that's pretty much because he signed his name with a cross, and at the bottom of the cross, it slipped down looking like a little bit of a dagger. So he got that nickname, John Dagger Hughes. But, you know, his personality, he was not your gentle neighborhood priest. He was a fighter. He defended his people. He had to. There was nobody there for them. The boot of England followed them over here to the U.S. And, you know, he had to stand up and give them dignity and find a way to have them pull themselves up by their bootstraps and move on with life and try and find a way, at least not for their current generation, but for the future generations.
John Hughes helped pave the way for the Roman Catholic Church to become the largest and most powerful denomination in the United States. It certainly might not have been true when Hughes lived, but by the beginning of the 20th century, it certainly was. And because of that influence and because of that power, now I'm not saying that John Hughes did that all by himself, but he was a major contributory factor to that. And in a way, John Hughes and his experience as Bishop of New York and the issues that he dealt with as Bishop of New York, we see the fulfillment of that, the culmination of that, in the election of John Kennedy as the 35th President of the United States. From helpless immigrant coming off of a ship in New York Harbor without penny of purpose, barely able to take care of themselves, to putting an Irish Catholic in the White House. The Irish immigrant had come of age in America.
And a special thanks to Joey for putting that piece together. And thanks to Bill Duggan and Richard McCann and Richard McCann's book, John Hughes, Lion of American Catholicism, can be found at Amazon and all the usual suspects. The boot of England followed Catholics to the United States. Destroyed by famine and persecution in their home country, they faced resistance here. And as always, men of courage, men of faith, in this particular case, challenged other men of faith. Martin Luther King did the same thing with letters from a Birmingham jail. That letter was addressed directly to pastors and priests throughout the South who weren't doing the right thing, and he challenged them to do the right thing. If you missed our previous podcast, please go back and listen to it. We have the story of Sergeant Stubby, the street dog turned war dog turned mascot, the story of how Abraham Lincoln used the telegraph to win the Civil War, and the story of Joplin, Missouri, and how they recovered from the costliest tornado in American history, plus many, many more. Thanks again for listening. I'm Lee Habib, and this is the Our American Stories podcast.